This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Charles Johnson, one of our leading thinkers and writers and philosophers, who's written so many award-winning books and articles, and as Emery, his cartoons coming back out. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But this is the 25th anniversary of Middle Passage, one of the great, incredible works of all time that he won the National Book Award for in 1990, and joins us here again for another conversation about this 25th anniversary of The Middle Passage. And Charles Johnson, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me back, Mark.
So, you know, the first obvious question is, 25 years, and when you look back on a book like The Middle Passage, and many people know the name of the book, even people who haven't read it. Right? Right?
Well, I didn't invent the name.
No, exactly.
Very common.
But to look at this book now, before we get into the heart of it, after these 25 years, especially given all the other things you've done and written in these 25 years, and how your spiritual aspect of you and your consciousness and your intellect has changed and grown as we all do, we morph, I'm curious how you feel now, looking back at this piece 25 years ago, as a different man.
Well, looking back 25 years ago to 1990, it seems to me amazing that so much time, a quarter of a century, has gone by since that night when it won the Fiction Prize and I gave a tribute to Ralph Ellison. But so it's made me very reflective about my life in general. I realize, looking at this book, that I've been publishing drawings and stories for 50 years now, since 1965 when I was a junior, 17 years old in high school. So it's kind of, you know, this book is sort of in the middle of that journey. Now, I have to say that I was very pleased this last summer when the director, executive director of the National Book Foundation, Harold Augenbraum, made a statement about the book. I'm going to read it for you because it's brief.
Please.
Harold says, "Middle Passage is a classic of American literature, filtering the traditions of adventure, personal redemption, and faith from Moby Dick and the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, and combining them with a thoroughly contemporary sensibility. It is destined to be discovered again and again by new generations seeking artistic expressions of literary, social, and political Americanness." Mm. I was really happy that Harold said that. He's outgoing now as director,
mm-hmm.
but he has an understanding of the history of National Book Awards, which I think started in 1950, and he feels that Middle Passage is one of the best novels to receive the Fiction Prize in that time.
I'm not saying this to be flattering. I think it is as well. I mean, I've read a lot of those National Book Award winners over the years, and rereading this, it just captured me in a different way than it did the first time.
Oh, good.
You know, I just love the way it's written. It just pulls you in, and it's also one of those books you have to at least I do have to stop and think. And even look
good.
Some things
That's
up.
Good. Yeah.
And even
yeah.
I had, all on the way, definitely looking some things up. So,
Well, you know, I hope it's an entertaining read, a rousing page-turning adventure story, a sea adventure story. One of my colleagues said something about it to me decades ago now. He said it starts out as a picaresque because Rutherford Calhoun is a picaro, in other words, a rogue. And then it becomes an epic as it moves into all these details of the daily life of slaves during the Atlantic slave trade. And then it comes to rest at the end as a romance between the main character, Rutherford Calhoun, and the woman he has fled and then desperately tries to get back to, like Odysseus trying to get back to Penelope, and that's Isadora Bailey. So it's a kind of layered book in terms of genres, and I hope the language is alive because, you know, the book is not that long.
No, it's not.
Novels go, but I threw out 3,000 pages over 6 years when I was writing it because I wanted a sense of compression and every paragraph counting for something in terms of advancing the story and entertaining the reader.
One of the things, a lot of pieces I like to parse out here in our time together today, but let me start with this. Because I've been reading a lot of stuff you've been sending out by email. And the pieces that are wrestling with, like the one you sent out, I guess, in August, Can Black Art Ever Escape the Politics of Race? By Vincent Cunningham. And we're still trying to organize that conversation there with you and Vincent to talk about this article, which we're going to do sometime in the near future. But when you read the book, I can see some people reading this book and going, where is the overt anger about the Middle Passage? Where is the analysis of capitalist greed in Middle Passage? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so I can see people looking at this and going, what you doing here?
Telling a story. First and foremost, telling a story. Well, you know, in my research, I spent 17 years of research on this book from the time I was an undergraduate, you know, on the slave trade. I even tried a version in 1971 that was not successful. And I came back to it after many other books in 1983, finished it in 89, and it was published in 90. But looking at my notes, they tell me that the slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade, lasted 315 years, that there were 20,528 voyages, that 12 million Africans were enslaved on those ships, and that 2 million didn't survive the voyage. This is one of the great tragedies of modern history. You know, we're talking somewhere at the beginning, probably in the 17th century, right into the 18th century. And I think in this novel, the horror is there.
Yes.
The horror is there in with granularity of detail. You're subjected to all kinds of things that these Africans, and I created a tribe, a specific tribe, for this novel called the Al-Musiri. I wanted them to be the most spiritual tribe on earth. You know, a whole tribe of Gandhis and Mother Teresa's and Pope Francis's. And they're brought onto this ship, but they're also brought into a different worldview than their own, which is represented by the imperialist, survivalist Captain Ebenezer Falcon, who is master of this ship. I think the anger is there, right? I think the horror is there.
I think so.
It's not muted. The humor is also there, too, because you're talking about human beings. We're talking about people. So we have a tapestry, in my opinion, of emotions. We have a continuum of emotions in Middle Passage.
And I guess I raise that because one of the things that you do, before I come back to the Al-Musiri, I think that's the descriptions of who they are in the book and also the characters who are of them are amazing. But it's because in some ways, you know, how can I put this? I'm trying to think of the right way to say this. That this is not a book about, it is about an individual in some senses, Rutherford Calhoun, the freed slave who sneaks the ship in New Orleans to flee from debtors and a marriage he didn't think he wanted and that ends up going to Africa to bring back a cargo of his of Africans to be enslaved here.
Yeah.
But it's like the individuals in this kind of cell represent, they meld into one another. They kind of dissolve between characters for me in this book. You know what I'm saying? Like self is an illusion, even though everybody is an individual.
Yeah, well, let me put it this way. When I first did the first version of this book in 1971, a lot of my research was based on ship's logs kept by slave ship captains. And I made the mistake of having the narrator, you know, the story was in the form of a ship's log, just as this version is. But I made the mistake of having the story told from the white ship captain's perspective. And that prevented me from actually entering into the sensibility and minds and hearts and souls of the Africans in the hold. So when I came back to the book in 1983, I said, okay, we're going to have a narrator, Rutherford Calhoun, who is an American. He is a freed slave who goes from the frying pan into the fire. when he stows away on this ship that he doesn't know is a slave ship. But the difference is now, with him as narrator, he understands the individual members of the crew and the individual members of the Al-Musayri tribe. He's a liminal figure, is what he's called. He's in between. So he's exposed to both world views. You know, when you look at most stories about the Middle Passage, or you see most films about the Middle Passage, the slaves in the hold are unnamed and unvoiced. They're like cattle.
Mm-hmm.
They're not given any individuality. Similarly, who were the people on the slave ship? You know, these guys on the slave ship that I created, they are all men who have failed on land, who go to sea as the last place that will have them. A slaver is the only place that they're going to be employed. So I wanted to give you portraits of the captain himself, and the ship's the first mate, Peter Kringle, and Tommy O'Toole, the cabin boy, and other characters. There are 80 people on this ship. There are 40 crewmen, and there are 40 Al-Musayri slaves. And their lives interact and intersect during this four-month voyage, which is finally one of the things we have to say about it, I think, because it is a story told by Rutherford Calhoun. It is a spiritual odyssey for him.
Mm-hmm.
It is a spiritual odyssey for Rutherford Calhoun. He is totally different after this experience than when we first saw him in New Orleans.
It's a spiritual journey for anybody who reads the book.
I hope so.
I mean,
because all my books have that template.
Right.
Whether it's a Dreamer about Martin Luther King, you know, in 1998, or Ox Herding Tale in 1982, I'm very interested in that dimension of our lives. It seldom gets profiled or dramatized in American literature.
And you did something here that you did in Dreamer as well that was interesting to me, because Malcolm X and Martin Luther King had such a huge influence on our generation, on generations beyond us and after
yes.
us. But King hasn't been explored in the same way, in some ways.
No.
You know? And I think that's one of the things you did, that you did with Dreamer.
Well, the critic, Mark Connor at Washington and Lee, he's provost now, he's a former student of mine too, he made the remark to me that I've probably written more fiction about King than anybody else. In Dreamer, he is a central figure along with a double for him.
Right.
And then there's a short stories I've written, like Dr. King's Refrigerator, which has been reprinted and anthologized quite a bit. And then lots of essays on King. There's one called The King We Need, in a book published a year ago called Taming the Ox, British
right.
Stories and Reflections on Politics, Race, Culture, and Spiritual Practice. So King, he figures deeply in my thought as an American philosopher. You know, he's only seen by some people as a civil rights leader, but he's much more than that. If you look at his body of thought, it is rich and exhaustive, as you would expect with any theologian who has got this incredible, you know, challenge of bringing spiritual ideals into the political realm.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important piece that we leave out, which is why this book to me, and we talked about The Taming of the Ox, and I think that when that first came out,
mm-hmm.
and I think that it's really critical in this age that we get into the complexity of it, which is sometimes when you explore the spiritual aspects of things, we are allowed to do,
mm-hmm.
rather than have this kind of linear way of looking at the world.
Absolutely. Well, you know, As philosophers have pointed out, nothing that is historical has only one meaning.
Right.
You know, what you know, it's not like our world lacks meaning. It is over-rich in meaning. And so the question is, which profiles of phenomena, I was trained as a phenomenologist, are you going to go with? Because the horizon of phenomena is endless. We will never reach the horizon of meaning. You know, so it's very complex. And it's that kind of complexity, thesis and antithesis, and you know, that sort of complexity that I try to get some of into my books.
Well, you do more than try, but so you know, I when you talk about the Al-Musayri, these people that were enslaved by, I think, as you wrote, the Arabs in the interior who brought people to the coast and sold them. You describe them in a way that is that they're about how ancient they are, about their they're coming from places that we don't even know and understand. You talk about parts of the ancient history that don't even fit into Africa necessarily when you describe it. If I say this correctly, I hope Mohenjo-Daro.
Mohenjo-Daro,
coming back from that time and that battle, sailing the sea. I mean, so this is and the kind of and the way you describe their language, which I'll read to the audience in a moment. So I mean, you really went into deep into a lot of the religious philosophical thinking that you read from Africa the East to bring this out.
Yes, well, the reason I created this tribe is because they occur. In a couple of other books and stories that I've done, I would find myself having to write an African character. And, you know, I said, okay, well, they're from this tribe called the Al-Musseri. And I found that in my notes when I was working on my first novel, Faith in the Good Thing, my notes, which is all about magic and folklore, I found that Al-Musseri was the name of a hut or a place where you did magic. Well, I later came to find out that actually it's an Egyptian word. And I just corrupted it. Al-Musseri means the Egyptian, right?
Hmm.
And the Egyptian airline is called Al-Musseri. And people who don't like to fly on it call it Al-Misery, right? So that's where it came from. But when I came to Middle Passage, I said, you know, one of the things I want to do with this book is open up this tribe I've only skimmed, you know, in an earlier novel and an earlier story. So I said, what I want to do is create an entire culture. That is, their language, their rituals, their history. I made them the original tribe of humankind, and there are things in their history that connect them to people in South America as well as India. That's your Mohenjo-Daro reference. If you look at that time, you're going to see sculptures in India that are very African-esque in features. Now, I cannot prove this, but a lot of people talk about it. There is an African presence there before the Aryans, as they were called, came with their city busters, right, juggernauts, and conquered these people, the Dravidians, and put them at the lower end of the caste system. I was talking recently to Lama Rangdrol, the black Buddhist teacher, and he has spent time with the Dalits, the untouchables. And he says, everywhere you go, you see sculpture that is Negroid or African in features. So there is a connection there with the Al-Musseri, in terms of this work of fiction, with other people on the planet.
I mean, you write in the book that they are an old people, older, some say, than the Kung tribe of South Africa, people who existed when the planet, the galaxy even, was a ball of fire and steam, not like us at all. No, not like you either. Though you are black, talking, of course, to the main character in the book about who these people were, and on that as well, you they play such an incredible role in this.
They do.
And the god that was captured by Falcon,
right in the hold of the ship.
The hold of the ship. I know when I read that first one, I said, "Where's this going to take us?" So,
hey, I thought the same thing too. No, seriously, I got to chapter 3, and we've accomplished a lot. We've got him out of New Orleans, onto the ship. He's met the sailors. They arrive in Africa. They get the slaves. They come on stage. And I felt something was missing. And I remember it was kind of like a summer night, summer afternoon. And I said, I can't think of what's missing in chapter 3. So I decided to go take a nap. And as soon as my head hit the pillow, you know, that state just before you fall completely asleep, I saw in my mind's eye the sailors bringing a crate out of the jungle. I sat up immediately. I said to myself, what's in that crate? Is it animal? Is it vegetable? Is it mineral? I mean, what is Falcon captured? And then it hit me. It's a god. He captured the god of the Al-Musseri because he's plundering their culture of all kinds of artifacts, just like the Islamic State is doing right now in Syria, right?
Mm-hmm.
Falcon has a standing order to bring back anything of value to the investors in the ship that he's in control of called the Republic. And he has captured an African god. Now, when I wrote that, I said to myself, you know, I may not be able to pull this off. if I get four or five more chapters in, I don't know what that means. I'm going to go back and write it out of Chapter 3. But by the time I got to, you know, Chapter 7 or 8 or whatever it was, I realized why the God was there. It is to reveal something to Rutherford that is close to his heart. The thing about the Al-Musiri God is it is not like Jehovah, you know, it's not like Allah. It's more like Krishna, the Hindu God, that is a manifestation of everything. So, in fact, it's only a manifestation of the God that Falcon has captured. And the guy actually feels rather amused by that because it's everywhere and in all places at all times.
I'll let our listeners just use your words here for a moment, if I might.
Okay.
Talking about the Al-Musiri God is everything. So the very knowing situation we mortals rely on, a separation between the knower and the known, never rises in its experience. You might say empirical knowledge is on man's side, not God's. It's our glory and grief both, a function of the duality of mind I mentioned a moment ago. Oh, 'tis a strange creature we have below Mr. Calhoun. Omnipresence means it forfeits our kind of knowledge. Omnipotence means, ironically, that it can create a stone so heavy it cannot lift that same stone from the floor. That's your God.
Yeah, that's the God. I like that passage a lot.
That's a great too, passage.
By the way, the God, he can't do geometry because he's immaterial, right?
Right.
If you have angels, you know, thrones and principalities, they're immaterial. So they can't do, you know, a science based on, you know, being a material embodied being. A lot of that, you know, I'm an old philosophy guy. You got to bear with me. A lot of that is medieval thought about the nature of God, as the medievals talked about him. So I kind of appropriated that for the Al-Musiri God. But the main point here is that the God is beyond dualism. The God is beyond all forms of dualism between knower and known and subject and object. One of the things that's important about this book is that the vision of the Al-Musiri is a non-dualistic, non-violent vision. The vision of Captain Falcon is very dualistic. So at one point, he tells Rutherford Calhoun, mind was made for murder, that there's always going to be this antagonism between subject and object and subject and subject. And Rutherford doesn't want to believe that because, you know, he's got the exposure to the Al-Musiri.
Now, when you mentioned Captain Falcon, let's talk about him for a moment before we come back to the Al-Musiri and some of the things that happen with Rutherford. But when I look at Captain Falcon, this dwarf who is the captain of this ship and a brilliant human being, well-read, crazed and powerful in many ways, he represents in a lot of ways kind of the world that's kind of stuck in only the West.
Yes.
Right? Whether it's the intellectual world that can justify their enslaving people despite its depth of understanding of all kinds of other knowledge, as well as kind of representing, saying, we have to do what the capitalists tell us to do. It's their ships. I'm getting these slaves. We're all making money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's like the contradiction of it all.
Well, you know, in every novel, not every novel, but a lot of novels, we have what's called a magnet character, or in a play. And that's the character who steps on stage and suddenly sucks up all the energy in the room, right?
Right?
So it's like you go to a party, and there's got to be one person, you know, that everybody's listening to, right? Because of the force of their personality and their brilliance. That's Captain Falcon. He's the novel's magnet character. Now, I have had him on my mind for quite a while in a certain way. When I was in high school, I came across a book on Sir Richard Francis Burton, the explorer, one of the architects of colonialism, the man who translated the Arabian Nights, a brilliant man who also happened to be an incredible racist. And I couldn't figure out how someone could be so brilliant and at the same time so wrong. I read that biography twice, I remember, in high school. Then a little bit later, you know, I spent about 6 years studying the literature of the sea, and that's Olive Melville and Jack London. And in Jack London's works, there is The Sea Wolf, which is a really interesting book because the main character, Wolf Larson, is a horrible sea captain, right? So there's a little bit of Sir Richard Francis Burton, a little bit of Wolf Larson, and a little bit of my friends in the martial arts who are survivalists in Captain Ebenezer Falcon. And by the way, you point something out very important. He is not in the master of that ship, ultimately. There are three financiers, three people who have invested in this run, which is illegal by the time it happens. You know, it still happens even after the British outlawed the slave trade around 1812, I think it was. Then the Americans followed. So this is an illegal run that's happening. And Falcon is getting 25% of the cargo. The ship's sailors, however, are getting just a few dollars, I have it in the novel, every month, maybe $12 a month, I think. So in other words, they're the proletariat. They are the ship's proletariat on this ship. And even Falcon is not free. If you look at this novel carefully, you'll see there's a lot of strong Marxist elements that run through it.
I noticed. I said I noticed. I mean, because that, I mean, that was 25 years ago. I know that you spent a lot of time studying Marx. You also spent a lot of time studying Eastern religion and philosophy and Buddhism, especially.
Yeah.
And as well as kind of understanding the African American literature and the literature and history of Africa. I mean, these are the things that kind of fueled your philosophical mind way into this novel.
Well, all those elements go into all my work, but they certainly go into all of Middle Passage, too. My master's thesis in philosophy was a study of Wilhelm Reich, Marx, and Freud.
Oh, wow.
And the possibility of creating a Marxist psychology.
Yeah.
Then in my early years at Stony Brook University, my first courses I taught as a grad student were on radical thought. And I taught everything from Marx's 1844 manuscript right down to Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. I was a Marxist. I was a socialist. And then at the same time, I found myself being a Buddhist. And I think I kind of drifted more in that direction over the decades, because I've been studying Eastern philosophy and loving it since, you know, I first meditated when I was 14 years old. And studied in college courses and everything I could read, texts on Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism. And then, you know, I spent the last 15 or 16 years studying Sanskrit. But I didn't really start to meditate until 1980. That was after I got through tenure at the University of Washington and realized, okay, I need to sit down and practice what I have been studying, you know, since my teens. I talk a lot about that in the book Taming the Ox, Buddhist Stories and Reflections on Politics, Race, Culture, and Spiritual Practice.
No, you do, it's a wonderful book, and one day we'll have to talk about Wilhelm Reich, but that'll be another day.
It's being taught now in three different places, three different schools in California, Seattle, and New York. It's being taught in a course that Cornell West is co-teaching in New York. I think it's something theological seminary.
Very interesting. That really is interesting. That'd be the conversation itself to see what his thoughts are on that book. You, in part of this book, this is come back to Rutherford for a moment.
Okay.
And Rutherford Calhoun. And when he sneaks, there's some passages in him, when he sneaks into Falcon's cabin.
Yes.
And let me just read a little passage, if I might, from your book and talk a bit about this. And so, because he prides himself on being able to do this, and he goes, "I felt the change come over me, a familiar sensual tingle that came whenever I broke into someone's home, as if I were slipping inside another soul. Everything must be done slowly, deliberately. First, the breath coming deep from the belly, easily, as if the room itself was breathing, limbs light like hollow reeds, free of tension, all parts of me flowing as a single piece. For I learned in Louisiana that in a ballet-like movements there could be no error of body, no elbows cracking into chair arms in a stranger's space to give me away. Theft, if truth be told, was the closest thing I knew to transcendence. Even better, it broke the power of the propertied class, which pleased me." Woof.
You like that? I like that passage. Well, you know what he's describing.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell
he's
us.
He's describing doing Tai Chi. He's describing how you move and breathe when you do Tai Chi Chuan. Yeah, I do my Tai Chi, my Yang style Tai Chi set every week, and so I got in that description. But he's actually stealing, and breaking the property, you know, the power of the property class at the same time. But that's a Tai Chi description.
It's a Tai Chi description to me. It was, and the reason I read it was because it was a Tai Chi description. My knees don't like Tai Chi as much as they used to, but it's a Tai Chi description. But it's Tai Chi meeting the consciousness of what happens to human beings who are enslaved,
yes,
and what you have to learn to survive.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, in Rutherford, he is a free man, but he had been a slave earlier, he and his brother, right? So he has all of the defensive mechanisms still operating. You know, he's learned how to deal with white people, let's put it this way, for the sake of his own survival. He lies sometimes. He is a thief, as a rogue, you know, he steals. And that's very important in terms of him later stealing something from the captain to give to the Al-Musiri slaves in the hold so they can free themselves. And there's two mutinies happening in the ship. One, the white crew against Falcon, and then one of the slaves against all of the, you know, white crewmen.
Right.
And Rutherford's in the middle of that, and he gives to the Al-Musiri something he hopes will allow them to free themselves. Now, you know, one of the things about this book that I like is it echoes the Amistad Revolt. The Africans take over this ship. They take it over. They kill most of the sailors except for the main characters. You know, Squibb, Josiah Squibb, the alcoholic cook, and Kringle. Mm-hmm. And Kringle makes a sacrifice for them about three quarters of the way through the book. This is a novel of testing what human beings are capable of surviving. And so Rutherford comes out at the end of the book a changed person. So when he sees the love of his life again on another ship, Isadora Bailey, she almost doesn't recognize him.
And no, of course not. He's physically changed, and he's emotionally and spiritually changed.
Absolutely.
And it, in the scenes you described of the two insurrections aboard the boat, aboard the ship,
mm-hmm.
they also spoke to me about how we in this culture, and since the onslaught of slavery in the Western world, are split and have a hard time finding a way back together. In other words, you know, the one of the reasons so many movements in the past have failed is over race.
Yes.
Whether it is them, the white sailors trying to take over the ship, and the Al-Musiri having their own plans about what to do with the ship.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? That it kind of really to me spoke to that.
Well, that's why the book, the ship is called The Republic.
Right. Exactly.
It's this Republic. With all of the conflicting groups in it that I could cram into this novel. One of the things that happens, though, is because of the agony of the crucible of survival that they have to go through during this voyage, Rutherford comes to the point where he doesn't want to see anybody killed. He says at one point to Kringle, "I don't know who's right or wrong on this ship anymore. I'm just trying to keep us all alive."
Mm-hmm.
And so that is his effort. And as things worsen on the ship, they begin, blacks and whites, to rely more on each other, and race is not a question.
So what is that saying in a larger philosophical sense for you?
I think what it's saying in a larger philosophical sense is that we are all part of each other, and we all need each other. That's what I truly believe. As a Buddhist, I truly believe in the interconnectedness of all life for all sentient beings. I truly believe also that the self is an illusion. It's a chimera. It's a lived illusion that has caused tremendous grief throughout history, but it is, in fact, a social construct. It is in fact, a chimera.
Well, there are two things here. I mean, A, that's what I was trying to say earlier in our conversation when I said what happens to individual identity in this book, that they seem to meld into one another. They meld away. Do you know what I'm trying to
mm-hmm.
And that was part of why I was trying to say I didn't articulate it very well earlier in our conversation.
No, I thought you did. That sense of acute hyper-individuality and self-consciousness falls away during this voyage when they have to work together in order to survive. So Rutherford comes out at the end as somebody, you know, who just can't do a lot of the selfish, egotistical, self-absorbed things that he was doing in New Orleans anymore. he comes across a young girl named Bolika, whose mother is thrown over the side of the ship during a storm, her African mother. And he automatically embraces her and takes her into his life as his adopted daughter. And for him, you know, everything comes first in terms of Bolika. You know, she eats first. She has to be comfortable for him to have any sense of feeling comfortable. This is what every father feels for his daughter or child, right?
Right.
Your child comes first before anything else in the world. And so, yeah, he gives up an awful lot of the youthful ignorance and selfishness that he had when he was in New Orleans before he stows away on the ship.
Yeah, I love that. You feel that as well. Also, as a father of three daughters.
it's wonderful having a daughter. Well, that's why I love doing the Adventures of Emory Jones Boy Science Wonder children's book series with my daughter.
Right.
She's the co-author. I get to illustrate it and be a cartoonist again, which is a delight for me. But these books are as much hers as they are mine, and the main character, Emory Jones, is named after her three-year-old son, my grandson, Emory. So it's a lot of fun.
So coming back to the other part of what I was thinking about as we were describing these revolts and more, is that this is part of the book doesn't always answer questions. It's part of what you have to, if you really read the book and think about the characters and the story, you're wrestling with things. And one of the things it seems to me that you wrestle with in this book is that while you can posit the horrors of the slave trade and the depth of racism in our world, which is very deep, I think, you also are kind of looking at that in the context of the larger humanity of mankind. And that somehow we've got to figure out how to acknowledge the horror of racism and slavery, racism in today's world and slavery that got us here. But understanding there's also that there's a world around that and winding its way through each other that we have to wrestle with that's beyond that. Does that make any sense?
Well, the way I usually phrase this to myself in terms of lots of things, but you're talking about race right now, I think the important thing is that we should see ourselves as not being bound by the past, but we should also see ourselves as not being blind to the past.
Right.
We have to acknowledge it. Now, on this ship, in this story, the El Mousseri are in the hold of a slave ship, and they have to revolt. They are a people of peace, but they have to kill this crew. And it takes a toll on them that the character Ingonyama, whose name means brave lion, if my research is correct, he's their leader on board the ship, it causes him a great deal of grief because he can see the change that has happened to his people. You see, when African tribes were brought onto ships, right, they were from different tribes, and the Europeans saw them all as being Africans. That's where we get the concept of Pan-Africanism, okay? It's when they were brought on those ships, their individual tribal backgrounds didn't matter. They were African black slaves.
Right.
So that transitional moment that happens between Africa and the New World, it happens, I'm saying and arguing in this book, on those ships.
And that's one of the beauties of this book. And it's amazing to me how you kind of packed all that into just 206 pages.
I threw out 3,000 pages. Anything that was unessential. I mean, every sentence in a story or novel, in my opinion, has to justify its presence on the page. It has to delight the reader. It has to advance the story. It has to provide information. So I cut mercilessly. I had a whole other ending for this book, beginning about halfway through, around the time of the mutiny. I wrote the book in about 2 years. And then I looked at it, I realized that things were not right. I didn't have the mutiny of the sailors, you know, for example. So I spent the next 4 years replotting the book to get the ending that you have in the text before you.
Well, you can feel that in the way this book is written. We're talking with Charles Johnson, one of America's great philosophers and writers. We're talking about the book, The Middle Passage, and its 25th anniversary coming out now that won the National Book Award in 1990. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. I'm here with Charles Johnson, who's the award-winning author and philosopher and writer, talking about his book, The Middle Passage. In his 25th anniversary edition, he's written incredible fiction, Dr. King's Refrigerator, Dreamer, won the National Book Award for the book we're talking about now, and is, I think, just one of our most important thinkers in America, and joins us once again. And so, you know, one of the things, again, going back to this relationship between...
Can I make one quick footnote?
Sure, please do.
You just made me realize something, Mark.
Uh-oh.
This is November 6th.
Yes.
The night it won, Middle Passage won the National Book Award,
yeah,
was the 17th of November, 1990.
Wow.
So the ceremony is coming up again in 2 weeks or so. And I've, you know, I'm looking at my calendar right now. I've been a National Book Award judge three times now and chaired the panel for fiction twice. And I'm just realizing the award ceremony is coming up probably on the 18th. It's usually a Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And the judges all make their decision that day at lunch.
Really? Are you a judge this year?
What they have now is a short list of 10, a long list. It's a long list of 10 in September. October, they narrow it down to a short list of 5. And then in November, the winners are selected from each category on, you know, the 17th in 1990. Probably it's going to be the 18th this year, about a week and a half from now.
So are you on the selection committee this year?
No, not this year.
Not this year, just checking. But so that's interesting. So this is a propitious moment to do this, have this conversation.
Good timing.
Good timing. It makes me think, I remember reading that when you gave your acceptance speech in 1990, that you gave a special tribute to Ralph Ellison and to The Invisible Man.
That's right.
And that says a great deal about the way you look at writing novels and about why you did this in some ways. So talk a bit about that, but also about how you feel about that 25 years later.
Well, that was a great night. I was told that Mr. Ellison stood up when I read the tribute to him. I couldn't see because of the lights in my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But afterwards, we did interviews together, he and I.
Wow.
And he said to me something very poignant. He said, I thought I'd been forgotten. Mr. Ellison did something that was a major achievement, in my opinion, and the opinion of many others, in 1953, I believe it was, when he won the National Book Award, the first black American to do so. In my acceptance speech, which, by the way, Random House, I believe they have his novel, they're doing something interactive with Invisible Man and articles about it, and that acceptance speech is I just gave them permission to use that in this interactive project that pertains to Invisible Man. You know, in my acceptance speech, I quote Ellison by saying, you know, what he wanted to achieve was a story with all the bright magic of a fairy tale. That's a quote. And that he wanted to leave sociology to the sociologists. And in many ways, that's what I would like to think my books do. They're very philosophical. You know, I mean, they're drenched in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't go off into ideology. I don't go into sociology. I want a novel to have that wonder and mystery, and as he says, all the bright magic of a fairy tale for the reader's experience.
Well, it makes so much sense, and of course, we lost him 4 years after you won that award, and
that's right.
I'm going to come back again to just for a moment to Rutherford Calhoun and to the almissary and the god that they was imprisoned below, and who was amazing, changing faces and more, changing being, I should say. And when Rutherford is in the hole.
Yes.
The conversation he has with that god and what that god became was really, to me, profoundly moving. I mean, when the god becomes his father.
Yes.
Who would run away to be free and left his family behind.
Yes.
And he always had to wrestle with who his father was. You know, and he it goes to the heart of what slavery did to human beings, both internalized violence, but the need for freedom and all the rest. I mean, that was really an amazing way to kind of get into the heart of that psychology and what that did to people, and still what it does in some ways to people today.
Yes. Well, Rutherford has got this nagging problem that carries through his entire life, which is, who is my father? Why did he leave us? And the God takes the form of his father and lets him see what happened to him and what happened to him after his death. Because in order to really understand his father, you know, the God provides a context that involves almost the entire universe in which his father is a part. And then Rutherford, there's a line in there. I don't know if you highlighted it.
Which one's
after
that?
That revelation from the God, Rutherford suddenly knows the God's name.
Yes.
Rutherford. In other words, he is the God as well.
Exactly. When he talks about it, when the God is the Father here, and saying, look what they've done to us. Look how we live in.
And that's his father talking, right?
Right, his father talking. And he couldn't look at his wife Ruby in the face when they made love without seeing how much she hated him for being powerless, even with their own children, who had no respect for a man that had been whipped more than once by an overseer and knew in this world his word was no better than theirs. But just the power of that moment.
You know, that's unfortunately and tragically, that's a timeless moment. That could describe black men in the present world.
Yeah, exactly.
Black men during the era of segregation, as well as black men during the period of slavery.
I just the power of what that God does and how it transcends it all and becomes us, I think, is a very powerful piece of the story that that gets to us. And I guess, you know, I don't want to give too much away. There's so much in here. And when you talk about us coming together as a people, one of the things that I marked this piece off where he wrestles about why he wants to go back to America.
Yeah.
Right? And he goes, there as I lay weakened from bleeding was where I want to be, talking about America. Do I sound like a patriot? Brother, I put it to you. What Negro in his heart, if he's not a hypocrite, is not?
That's a line I know a lot of people pondered.
pondered, and some people got really angry about it as well, I would imagine.
No, Rutherford is a patriot. Ultimately, he understands that black Americans created this country right alongside white Americans. If you take black Americans out of American history, there is no American history, right?
Amen.
He understands that, and he understands as well, as he says in the text, that there's dangers here. There's difficulty here, but he can handle it. In other words, he has a sense of agency, finally. He has a sense of, I know my capabilities, finally. And racism is not going to overwhelm him. He has gone through one of the worst experiences you could imagine on this ship. And I think he feels that he's up to the occasion of almost any challenge after this voyage is over. Because what happens? He's rescued, along with the ship's cook and little Balika, on a pleasure boat. And he has one last challenge.
One last challenge.
He has to deal with to get Isadora back in his life.
Again, I don't know how you did this in 206 pages. I've always wondered why this book, and I know it was optioned once and you were working on a script, why was this book never made into a movie?
Oh, we have been at three studios with this. The Hudlin Brothers, Warrington, took it to TriStar, and they were going to do it, except they wanted to take out the God. And Warrington said no. And then we were at Interscope, and I wrote a screenplay, an adaptation at TriStar, and then I did another one at Interscope with Reggie Hudland, and we opened up that story. You know, in the story, you don't see the Africans captured.
No, right.
In the screenplay, there's a whole act where Falcon goes into the interior, like into the heart of darkness, and captures. It's a battle. I mean, I was shaking as I was writing it, right? Where the Al-Musiri cult, we see the culture before the sailors arrive. Rutherford sees it because he escapes from the ship and the Al-Musiri capture him. So he spends like a day or two with them. And then the ship's crew comes in and just destroys the village and hauls them all back to the ship. So there was an act in that screenplay, which, by the way, Reggie is trying to get done as a graphic novel. We have about 12 pages that have been drawn by Dennis Cohen.
You're not drawing it?
No. Dennis Cohen is good. He's a veteran. No, he's
I'm
a
just
comic
teasing.
Book veteran. The pages are beautiful. So we need to get a graphic novel out of this, and Reggie's working on that. And then the third studio we were at was Warner Brothers, where John Singleton, he said, if I could do this book, it would make my career, right? But he optioned it, and then a year, the option ran out. And after it ran out, he sent me a message, and he said, well, I've finally found my Captain Falcon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the person he has is, what's the actor's name? He's short of stature.
Oh, the guy who plays in the... I know exactly who you're talking about. I can't think of his name. He's in that HBO series.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Dinklage.
Yes, right. Exactly. Right.
Peter Dinklage.
Exactly right.
He could be Captain Falcon. So if you're going to do a movie and you're going to do this,
he could be a great Captain Falcon.
It's going to cost $100 million, and you've got to cast this right. It's got two problems. It's on the water. Shot on the water, and that's hard to control, and it's also a costume drama.
Yes.
That is to say, it's a period piece. So all the props have to be period, just as they were in Titanic, right? I mean, for him, even the silverware was period that the actors are eating off.
Right.
So
what
every
you described,
year that goes by, it's ka-ching, ka-ching. This is going to be a more expensive film to make, and that's a big risk for a studio. I mean, I'm fully aware of that. But I have hope that it will someday be made into a film and made well. There's a screenplay already done that we did at TriStar. I did in collaboration with Reggie Hudlin that would be wonderful to film. But you've got to have a great director. You've got to have a fantastic director to pull off all the things that we're talking about, for the last hour in this particular novel.
I would wait with great anticipation for that day to come. And I want to say this. I always enjoy having our conversations on the air together.
I love talking to you, Mark. You are so knowledgeable and so compassionately involved with social justice issues.
I have been there for a long time. And this Middle Passage 25th Anniversary, I really think it's an amazing book. People need to read this, wrestle with it, talk to it, talk with others about it. And Charles Johnson, thank you so much for all you bring to us and taking all this time out of your day and getting up early for you to come do this.
It's been a joy. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.